On the record on our first matter, 86028, Dixon v. State. Do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay. Good. Okay, you can begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Curry-Diamond and I represent Mr. Dixon in the proceedings before this court. Mr. Dixon was denied his right to a fair trial in three critical ways. First, that the instructions to the jury were incomplete as to the medical delay. The district court improperly denied a theory of defense instruction on proximate causation. And finally, that a biased juror who should have been removed for cause was not and ended up on the jury panel. So as to the first of these errors, that there was incomplete jury instructions. The jury was never instructed on what the appropriate standard was to consider whether Dixon had committed the crime of medical delay that resulted in substantial bodily harm via a neglect theory. The standard as pronounced by the Ninth Circuit.
The issue wasn't preserved at trial, is that correct?
Well, as in there was no jury instruction submitted by the defense, that's correct, Your Honor. However, there is an obligation to properly charge the jury, and the Ninth Circuit's pronouncement of what the elements are required would be something that the jury needs to be instructed on.
Do you think that Nevada law is clear enough that Mr. Dixon could prevail on plain error here?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. So even if this court were to consider it under a plain error analysis, plain error, there has to be some evidence. It has to be supported by the evidence and it has to affect the substantial rights of the defendant. And it did in this case because it lowered the burden of proof for the state. The jury clearly struggled with this issue because they asked a jury question about whether or not they were supposed to consider what Mr. Dixon knew at the time in the apartment. And so this knowledge requirement that we see in criminal negligence cases that has been adopted by this court, criminal negligence is a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the actor's situation. Those elements of criminal negligence and the knowledge requirement as pronounced by the Ninth Circuit, not giving that instruction to the jury, substantially impacted Mr. Dixon's right because the jury just could not have considered that and could not have applied the facts to the law. And in this case, there was such a dearth of evidence that the jury would have found not guilty had they been properly instructed. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that they asked a question to the court as to what they were considering, what they were supposed to consider as to Mr. Dixon's knowledge requirement.
So what exactly do you think should have been in the jury instruction?
So as the Martinow case had discussed, that there should be the jury should have been instructed that there has to be a time lapse between the injury and the contacting of 911 or seeking medical care. And importantly, that the defendant knew or should have known that the child was in need of immediate medical care.
So how in the instructions what's the interplay between what the state has alleged in their charging document, the elements of the offense that they have to prove, and the instructions as per statute? Because in the charging document, they specifically say it's a delayed medical treatment that is the basis of count three.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, there was no indication to the jury as to what knowledge was required. So the instruction would need to tell the jury that the state needs to prove either actual or implied knowledge on Dixon's part, that either he knew or should have known that the child was in need of medical attention and then delayed that medical care.
Well, if the element of the crime is that the defendant delayed medical treatment, doesn't that imply that medical treatment was needed, which implies that there was some issue requiring medical treatment, like an injury?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, knowledge, I think, is a really important component of that, right? Because say you have a child that has cancer, and you don't necessarily know that the child has cancer, right? And maybe the child is acting lethargic or is just having some fatigue. And so you do home remedies, you give them more vitamin C, or you change their diet, or you do all of these other things, but not necessarily knowing that the child would need some type of higher medical care until maybe that the cancer's now gone on to stage four, right? The knowledge requirement is necessary. And that's really what we saw as well in Martinow in the Ninth Circuit, right? The Ninth Circuit had these facts that analyzed that the parents didn't have knowledge. There was no direct evidence that the parents had knowledge of the injury to the child. And a lot of times what happens in these cases, as was done in this case, is they're charged in conjunction with either a permit or allowing of the abuse, or as someone who caused the initial abuse, right, and then delayed the medical treatment. But even in those cases, such as in Rice versus State from this court, and Smith versus State from this court, and recently in Miller versus State from this court is still engaging in a knowledge analysis. In each of those cases, the defendant knew of the injury or knew of the abuse or knew that the spouse was causing the abuse, knew that the child then needed medical care and delayed getting that medical care. So this court is already engaging in an analysis of knowledge, and that knowledge is required on the part of the defendant. And in those cases, the state was able to prove by direct evidence that, or circumstantial evidence, that there was knowledge on the part of the defendant. But as in Martinow, and as in this case, importantly, there is no direct evidence of abuse or of knowledge of the actual initial injury that would have necessitated the need for immediate medical care. And when he became aware of the need for immediate medical care, which was when the child started vomiting and seizing, he did call 911 and he did get that immediate medical attention. So that is one of the things that I think is important, because the doctors and the experts in this case were talking about how the first manifestations, this was a slow brain bleed, where there would be a period of lucidity, there would be a window of lucidity that an ordinarily prudent person wouldn't necessarily know that the child, who, if they had not observed that the child had hit their head, would not necessarily know that the child hit their head and was suffering from a severe injury. Not until those first manifestations of the head injury show, as in seizures and vomiting. And when that occurred, Mr. Dixon called 911. So he did, as soon as he understood and had knowledge of the need for immediate medical care, he sought out that medical care.
And the jury found that he was not responsible for those injuries, is that correct?
That's correct. So the jury did find not guilty on him causing the initial injury, manner means unknown, or by shaken baby. So what we're looking at is really, what are the elements when there is just medical delay, and what is the temporal requirement of those? And I think that Martinow and this court's decision in Rice really kind of adopt Martinow in accepting those evidentiary standards of there needs to be a delay between injury and contacting 911, and that there be knowledge on the part of the defendant.
But you didn't, below there was no alternative jury instruction presented, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But because I don't believe it would necessarily have been a special instruction, right? This is more akin to Ramirez versus State, where elements of the offense are not being fully instructed to the jury and thereby causing reversible error.
Oh, and Martinow, that's a Ninth Circuit case, correct? So if we get there by plain error, we have to ensure that this is something that is settled law under our jurisprudence. And how do we get there if we have not adopted Martinow?
So in Martinow came out in 1994, and in 1996, this court had discussed the evidentiary factors required by Martinow in Rice versus State. So I think that if the court doesn't find that they fully adopted the Martinow evidentiary standard in that case, in Rice versus State, the defendant had, the child had several severe burns on their back, and the defendant knew of the burns, treated the burns, knew that her spouse had caused the burns, and had actually given testimony that she wanted to take the child to the hospital, knowing that the child needed medical care, but was afraid of her spouse, and so she didn't get that medical care. But in this court's analysis of Rice versus State, the court found that because she knew that the child was in need of immediate medical attention, the evidentiary requirements of Martinow had been satisfied. So even if this court is not accepting that as a full adoption of Martinow, the court at least engaged in an analysis of those evidentiary standards of Martinow back in 1996. Um, So obviously this is a criminal negligence case, and at the heart of the criminal negligence, even though this court hasn't really fully discussed what that would require as far as medical delay is concerned, the California Supreme Court has in discussing child neglect and negligence and criminal negligence. And the California Supreme Court also agrees that the conduct must show an indifference to the consequences and that there has to be a required knowledge of actual or imputed and an act that tends to endanger the child's life. So the California Supreme Court is agreeing with that. This court has agreed with the Ninth Circuit, at least in, to some extent, in Rice. And then the Ninth Circuit has discussed what the knowledge requirement is for these types of cases. Secondly, Your Honors, the defense was improperly denied their theory of defense instruction in this case on the proximate causation. The defense presented approximate causation instruction. This is a negligence case. The court recognized that it was a theory of defense case. The court stated, we can see that this is where you're going with your cross-examination. We can see that you're gathering this evidence throughout your cross-examination. And the court was then obligated, if it didn't feel like it was a correct statement of law, was obligated to work with the parties in order to craft a correct statement of law on the proximate causation theory of defense instruction. And because it was proposed and denied, that is reversible error as found by this court previously.
What evidentiary basis was there for an intervening or superseding cause type instruction?
So there was a lot of discussion about the malignant cerebral edema and how this is kind of a medical marvel in that not every head injury results in this malignant cerebral edema, that these they're unpredictable. We don't know when they're going to happen. When they do happen, they can create kind of an emergent situation that they're not really sure whether or not the child will die or live or anyone who's having these injuries. And that was crafted through cross-examination that there was this condition of the malignant cerebral edema and how that potentially affected the substantial bodily harm. And that was what the defense proposed as their theory, one of the theories of defense that they proposed, and specifically as an instruction.
And that,
what?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, what? I mean, I guess I'm not following. I mean, was there an expert that came in and said to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, this child had some type of intracranial cerebral issue separate from something occurring in the father's care?
Yes. So when the head injury occurred, there was several experts that talked about how there was this development of this secondary
injured brain swells.
Right. And that this malignant cerebral edema doesn't happen in every head injury, and they can't predict when it will happen, and that when it does happen, it can increase the likelihood of harm.
But I mean, was there some indication in the evidence that that issue just arose on its own, separate from the child having been injured falling on the stairs?
No, there would have to be obviously an initial triggering event for the head injury.
Okay. So how is a result from the initial head injury an intervening cause somehow? Seems to me it just stems from the initial injury.
Well, because he was found not guilty of causing the initial injury, the medical delay and the substantial bodily harm that results from the medical delay would have had to have its own independent evidentiary basis that the substantial bodily harm was caused specifically by the medical delay. And so this cerebral edema that maybe exacerbated the issue or the harm to the child is not necessarily tied to the medical delay and that exacerbation of that injury.
Great. Did you want to reserve any
yes.
of your time?
Yes, please. Yes, yes, thank you.
State. May it please the court. Good morning, Honorable Justices and Chief Justice for today, Herndon. I will address the primary issues I believe are before the court, also reflecting your discretion you just had with counsel. The state's position, or the respondent's position, is that the jury was properly instructed on medical neglect. The fact of the matter is the definition of abuse and neglect contains the very key language, which is in instruction 6, under circumstances which indicate that the child's health or welfare is harmed or threatened with harm. That is objective language where the jury had to consider the totality of facts and circumstances.
But what about the knowledge requirement? I mean, just as a practical matter, if your kids fall down all the time and they get hurt, if you don't know and recognize that they are, having a serious medical issue, should they be liable? So should there be a knowledge requirement imputed as in the Martineau case?
I believe that there has to be some evidence that the child needs medical care. If you call it knowledge, if you call it objective evidence of their condition, but there is overwhelming evidence in the state's position in this case that Dixon recognized that his child had an injury from what he claimed was the fall, that he connected that injury. So the fall happens at 9 a.m. on October 19th. Mm-hmm. By 3 p.m. that same day, he's having a conversation with Candace, who testified at trial, that at 3 p.m. his child was acting, quote unquote, loopy, maybe a little dazed and confused. And he said to Candace, he connected that to the fall. So he knew by 3 p.m. the day it happened that she had an injury. He told Candace he was going to take her to the hospital the following morning, and yet he did not. He did not call 911 start trying to call 911 until 4:14 p.m. the following day. So more than 25 hours after that had occurred. Additionally, he called the mother of the child at 12:34 p.m. on the day of the 20th, and he told Detective Hoyt, as well as Darren Taylor, that the child's not talking, a very talkative child, not talking, not walking, not running. He's also not saying there's something at home he's offering her to help her get better. He told Detective Hoyt, essentially, she was really tired. I just know in my mind that she was going to open her eyes and was going to wake up and start running to me. He had no home remedy. He had no hope other than a miraculous recovery that this child was going to get better. So we have overwhelming evidence from his timeline that he gave to Detective Hoyt in his testimony at trial that he had that knowledge by 3 p.m. the day that this injury happened, and yet he did nothing. And that's where the substantial bodily harm comes in, I think. So there's the state's position is the objective language under circumstances which indicate the child's health or welfare is harmed or threatened with harm. But he also, for the substantial bodily harm, we had evidence of that as well. So it's, in all candor, a little dicey when we get to head injuries, right? Because we can't test her before the surgery and see what her capacity is and test her after the surgery and see if there's a difference. And there's obviously no medical intervention until we get to the point where it's essentially too late. By the time she gets to Summerlin and transferred to UMC, which was very quickly, it was essentially too late because the swelling got to such a degree that surgery was immediately necessary. Multiple doctors testified about the delay, and that the delay under the definition of substantial bodily harm is an increased risk of death. Although I think the defense expert, Dr. Sims, put it most succinctly. He said on 9AA2169, the fact that she has an expanding space-occupying lesion, which he had described as the swelling in the blood in her brain from the initial injury at 9 a.m. that day, over the course of time until she got to the hospital, the continued blood is causing that to expand and to grow in her brain. So the blood and the swelling is competing in that confined space with her brain. So he says the fact that she has an expanding space-occupying lesion in her brain, she's at risk for death. And then he talked about how there's other quotes that we have as well, where multiple doctors said a delay in treatment would have caused further either lack of oxygen, this is Dr. Settle, to some parts of the brain or collapsed parts of the brain, more swelling, lead to worsening outcome. Dr. Settle also testified that surgery improves the chances to survive. And there was such a delay in getting her to the hospital and getting her to that surgery that is where the substantial bodily harm.
Okay, I just want to go back to the issue of knowledge, though, because the jury was clearly grappling with this issue, right? Because it asked the question whether it had to consider the injuries to AD or whether they were to consider what Dixon thought at the time he was in the apartment. So they were grappling with this knowledge issue. Like, what is that element? And was that element presented to the jury in such a way where they could understand that, yes, he had to understand and know and appreciate that she was in medical distress at the time?
But I think the reasonable person standard is that objective standard, because Martineau says a reasonable person knew or should have known. It's not a subjective standard of what Dixon knew. It's an objective standard. And the court's response says, if you're considering Mr. Dixon's actions, consider if his actions were appropriate under the totality of the circumstances as defined in the legal definition of child abuse, neglect, or endangerment. And I think that properly captures it. And the state's position is, even if this court thinks there should have been an instruction regarding knowledge, and maybe going forward that would be the better practice for this courts to have, there's still harmless error in this case because there's such overwhelming evidence that he knew she needed medical care for more than 24 hours and did nothing.
Do you think that the wording of the verdict form compounded, well, if we assume that the instruction was
sure
lacking that information about knowledge, then you have a verdict form that says child abuse, neglect, or endangerment with substantial bodily harm as opposed to resulting in. So there's two places that the jury is getting information that maybe isn't completely clear.
I understand, and in looking at instruction 2A, which is a copy of the information, those titles there actually have the same language, the with substantial bodily harm. But if you read the elements under each of the charges 1 and 3, especially 3, it says resulting in substantial bodily harm. Instruction 8, which defines substantial bodily harm, which says you have to determine if you find it, says if substantial bodily harm resulted. And instruction 2 says you can't read one instruction without the others. And so I think looking at the information and the title, I think it would have been more confusing, honestly, if we had put a different title in the verdict form than what was in the information. Could it have been done better? Yes. Do I think it warranted the jury being confused and not being able to do their job with the totality of instructions? No. So then the other issue that's come up is Dixon's proposed defense instruction. And I would note in Sanchez-Dominguez versus State, the defendant is not entitled to misleading, inaccurate, or duplicative instructions. And frankly, the state's position is that Dixon's proposed instruction was inaccurate and misleading to the jury. The proposed instruction said the defendant is guilty of the crime of child abuse and neglect only if his behavior causes substantial bodily harm to the child. That is 100% incorrect. The verdict form had 3 options: child neglect or endangerment with substantial bodily harm, or not guilty. He had 3 options, and this instruction essentially says you have two choices, guilty or not guilty. And then when it gets to intervening cause, that actually was not, with all respect to Honorable Bluth, in reviewing the doctor's testimony, the doctors did not adopt the defense attorney's questions when she said malignant cerebral edema being an intervening superseding cause, with a caveat to Monty's. But Dr. Garber testified on 1246. He was asked, is cerebral edema is different from malignant cerebral edema, correct? His response was no, it's effectively the same. And he described it as a secondary deterioration. Dr. Montes, in what I believe is a convoluted question, was asked, and even when malignant cerebral edema is a supervening event and a deterioration that is an independent superseding event, that's your opinion? He essentially said yes. And then on redirect, I clarified whether or not a patient would develop malignant cerebral edema without the initial injury to the brain. And he said it has to have some kind of triggering event to have cerebral edema, not just arise out of nothing. So it's not as though, by way of example, the state's position is a superseding intervening event is if someone's being transported in an ambulance to the hospital in cardiac arrest and that ambulance gets into a car accident and the patient now has a broken leg. That is clearly a superseding intervening event that has nothing to do with whatever caused the heart issue. However, if you look at COVID-19 patients and the history that we've had, some COVID-19 patients develop the virus, get a low-grade fever, have headaches, sleep for a couple days, they're better within a few days. There were other patients who contracted the same exact virus who, after a few days, had to go to the hospital due to difficulty breathing, developed organ failure, and some of them unfortunately eventually died. We wouldn't say it was a superseding intervening event that resulted in their death or their organ failure. It was a progression of the COVID-19 virus in their body. Was it unpredictable? Yes. Was it uncommon? Yes. But it was a known complication and progression of that. Similarly, all the doctors in this case described the malignant cerebral edema as a progression of the original edema and swelling of the child's brain. So Dixon's proposed instruction was appropriately rejected in this case.
Counsel, could you talk a little bit about the argument by Dixon regarding juror number three and the inferred bias? My understanding is that she indicated that she had experienced child abuse and that it would be difficult for her to be impaneled, but then ultimately said she thinks she could make it. I think that was her language. And so, you know, just if you can talk a little bit about that. I know there's Hall v. State, but then there's a Court of Appeals decision as well in Sayedzada. So if you could just speak to that a little bit. I'm curious to know what the state's, elaborate on the state's position.
You're both aware, because I think your briefing may have been completed before this happened.
I think there was
The Court of Appeals issued a decision in Young v. State based on Sayedzada, and we granted a writ petition on that. So it's under advisement from this court right now on the issue of inferred bias, implied bias, et cetera.
Oh, I was not aware. Makes it a little more interesting of an argument.
That's why I bring it up, just to get your take on it. Yeah.
Most of my citations were to Sayedzada. The state's position is, yes, she generally disclosed child abuse, but child abuse, unlike the facts in Sayedzada and the other cases, is such an overarching, broad term. What she described as being her experience with child abuse can clearly be called excessive corporal punishment, which is not allowed under the statute. But here, this juror described her experiences being struck with cables, other objects, force on her knees, on rocks, holding something on her head for hours. It's conduct that is remarkably dissimilar from the charges that she had to address as a member of the jury, in that the charges against Dixon at the time of trial were for pinching the ear, causing injury to the ear, causing abusive head trauma, and then medical delay. None of those are similar in nature to the type of experiences she had at the hands of her grandmother. And she did. She said she acknowledged that things were different in Mexico, which is where it happened to her. She said she could set aside her experience and make the decision based solely on the evidence. She said she could be fair to both sides. She didn't respond when I asked during voir dire if any person favors one side or the other, though other people did. She did not. She said she could wait in forming an opinion. And when Mr. Sly followed up, he did ask her those questions. Do you think it's going to make it hard for you to be fair in this case? And she said, it's going to be hard, but I think I can make it. Why do you think so? Because it brings me memories. I don't know how to explain, but I will do my best. And to me, she's more like juror 38 in the Sayedzada case, where the court found that her experiences, though they were of the same, a credit card fraud in both cases, the experience of the juror as well as in the Sayedzada case, they were not so closely similar to those of the victim or what was being discussed and tried in the Sayedzada case. So I think she's more like juror 38, where the juror there did not express more than a possibility of bias arising from her experiences, where she could be fair and impartial and didn't believe her experiences would affect her ability to fairly judge the case. And in reviewing the trial transcript, we all get to Monday morning quarterback our trials, because no trial is perfect. The record just isn't in the state's position fully developed on that issue. And I don't believe it's developed enough to overturn it based on her being sat on the panel. Could we go back and do things better? Absolutely. But I don't think there's enough information from her to constitute inferred bias that required her to be removed from the jury or removed for cause. And it was a question of fact that the judge had to make at that time. And I would note that if you continue reading the transcript where there's that discussion about kicking juror number three, the judge went on to describe juror 16 as having emotion, being crying, being biased against the defendant. The kids are going to be vulnerable. And I think that the totality of the record of contrasting juror three and juror 16 shows that the judge made a sound decision in not releasing juror number three for cause. Any more questions? I have lots more to say, but my time is up.
Can you say it in 16 seconds?
I cannot, but I appreciate you all so much. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
So I think what's critically important is that even though the state is talking about all of this overwhelming evidence, the jury was never able to consider that because they just weren't properly instructed. And by casual inspection of the record, they just weren't given the knowledge requirement to consider fully what the facts were.
And what about counsel's argument that the instruction given imputes this knowledge into the instruction?
Well, I think that the jury struggled with that, right? Because if it really truly imputed that, then the jury is not asking the question as to whether or not they need to consider his knowledge.
Okay, and they were instructed that willfully is defined as an intentional act or omission, right? So that you intentionally omitted seeking medical treatment, which is knowledge that medical treatment's needed, right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that when we're talking about the willfulness definition, right, is that it's done not accidentally or inadvertently and designedly or deliberately, which is the instruction that they're given, versus what the actual knowledge is of Dixon. And obviously, the jury struggled with that.
Well, but you're not suggesting that they should have been instructed that Dixon had knowledge that the child was suffering from an intracranial bleed and or edema and was in need of da-da-da-da. It's that he knew that she was in need of medical attention. Something was going on.
Yes, that she was in need of immediate medical attention. Yes.
The instruction says you intentionally omitted seeking medical treatment.
Right.
Then how does that not impute that you had knowledge that medical treatment was needed?
Well, I think what Martineau talks about is that there's a need for immediate medical attention, right? If there's a scrape on a leg, that could need medical attention, but whether or not that's immediate is really what takes it from, I guess, more regular negligence to and crosses it over into criminal liability, right? There needs to be some kind of understanding that there is a heightened standard for criminal negligence because it is a criminal liability, not just normal, ordinary negligence. And I think my time is up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.